Welcome to Melbourne University Up Close, a fortnightly podcast of research, personalities and cultural offerings of the University of Melbourne, Australia. Up Close is available on the web at upclose.unimelb.edu.au. That's upclose.unimelb.edu.au.
Hello and welcome to Up Close, coming to you from Melbourne University, Australia. I'm Dr. Shane Huntington. Despite significant efforts to utilise environmentally responsible energy sources, the current and future load requirements of our population necessitate the use of power generation that is greenhouse gas intensive. A reduction in the energy use seems unlikely, so it is appropriate to consider methods for capturing and storing CO2, carbon dioxide, produced by our industries. To this end, significant efforts in geosequestration are currently underway. Today on Up Close, we are joined by one of Australia's leaders in carbon capture and storage. Barry Hooper is the Chief Technologist of the CO2 Cooperative Research Centre at the University of Melbourne, Australia. Welcome to Up Close, Barry.
Good morning, Shane.
Let's start by talking about capture. What do we mean by carbon capture?
Well, of course, CO2 is the most prevalent greenhouse gas, and one of the main sources of CO2 is industry burning fossil fuels generally. One of the first aspects of carbon capture and storage is to capture, separate and purify the CO2 so that it can subsequently be sent off to storage, where it'll be taken out of the atmosphere. We're very much focusing on the separation techniques that you use for removing it from the gases. And the benchmark technique, if you like, is what we call solvent absorption. It is where you are absorbing CO2 into liquids, and these are then become rich in CO2, taking the CO2 out of the gas, and then that liquid is then put through another process where the CO2 is liberated in a pure form, thus leaving the lean solvent, as we call it, to go back and continue a recycle process. So it's an absorption of the CO2 and then stripping. So that's the workhorse for the industry, on the one in which we base a lot of our economics. But we're also looking at membranes, be they either polymeric or ceramic membranes, which in the crudest form sieve the CO2 out of gas streams. It is commercial in some applications in removing CO2 from natural gas. The third form that we look at is called adsorption, which is often confused with absorption, but it's actually where you remove CO2 onto solids. If you like, where you have silica gel in your camera case to remove water from the atmosphere, here you are using similar solids to take that CO2 out of a gas stream. Similarly, you then take that solid, which is laden in CO2, and then you process it to liberate it in a pure form. That's the adsorption process. Another one is where we're looking at cryogenics and hydrates, where you actually cool down the gas stream or remove the CO2 in a form which is either using the vapor liquid equilibrium to concentrate the CO2, or to have another, you can even use water to disrupt that and produce what we call hydrates.
We're talking about removing or capturing the carbon emissions primarily, in many cases, I suppose, where you have energy generation. I assume that these processes themselves take quite a bit of energy to actually do the job. How prohibitive is that at the moment?
The driver of our research in capture is to reduce the cost of capture. And one of those key aspects of that is in fact, an additional amount of energy that's required to separate those gases. The thermodynamics and the basic principles of taking a dilute gas and concentrating it is going to take some energy. And so whether you look at, if you say, a retrofit or an existing coal-fired power station, there will be, a parasitic load, an amount of energy that's taken out of the actual output of that power station to achieve that. I think that's something we have to realise, that we're changing. We're in a paradigm shift here, that yes, while it might take another 20% of the energy to that power plant, but you now got a situation where the power plant is now very, very low emission.
Mm. with the case of power plants and so forth, the intensity of the CO2, if you will, coming out is very high. It's very concentrated. It's easy to locate, as it were. Is it possible to use these sorts of techniques to extract CO2 directly from the atmosphere? Because we already know we have a problem with CO2. We can work on preventing greater increases in what's in the atmosphere, but is it possible to actually reduce what's already there using this sort of capture technology?
There are a number of groups who have talked about the direct removal of CO2 from the atmosphere, and certainly it's possible. The concept of acid rain, if you like, is where various contaminants are just being absorbed into the water that's coming down with rainfall. It's very easy to absorb, and you can get more complex chemicals to make that more efficient. The issues around removal directly from air are will also be economic, where we find it is more expensive to remove CO2 from, say, flue gases from power stations, which might be anywhere from 4% to, say, 15% carbon dioxide, to remove, and the lower concentrations lead to the more expensive forms. Where you're then going to say, I'm going to remove it from the atmosphere, which is at 380 parts per million, that is going to be a concern. I think there are opportunities where, for instance, if you had an energy source or a power station fueled by biomass, which you then removed CO2 from that emission stream, that effectively is going to be a reduction, considering that the biomass is renewable, will take CO2 out of the atmosphere through its processes. And that's certainly a way of getting reductions from the atmosphere.
You're listening to Melbourne University Up Close. I'm Dr. Shane Huntington, and we're speaking with Barry Hooper about carbon capture and storage. Barry, with regards to the CO2, once you've captured it, what does that look like? Are we talking barrels of waste? Is it solid, liquid?
Once you've captured the CO2, you get it into a pure form, and we're looking at then storing that in geological formations. You have to transport it from where it's captured to where it would be stored. The generally considered option is to look for locations which are within hundreds of kilometres, thousands of kilometres within a region. And to transport that, it's most appropriate to do it in pipelines. And the most cost-effective way to do it is to take that CO2 that's been purified, convert it from the gaseous form into a liquid or a liquid-like state, which is then pumpable, can be compressed and pumped to its injection site. In the main, people are focusing on the pipeline transportation.
Mm. And how exactly is it contained once it's in its final storage location? I assume this is deep underground and it is contained in some way?
The whole package, if you like, of carbon capture and storage is to capture it, transport it, and then store it in deep geological structures, if you like, putting the carbon back where it came from in a lot of cases. In that form, the CO2 in the pipeline is very dense. It's somewhat like a fluid. When you actually can inject that below 800 metres to a kilometre below the surface, it remains in that very highly dense form. And what you're looking for geological storage is a particular mix of rocks, because the reality what we're looking at is storing it in rocks. The crust of the earth is not made up with voids or the rocks aren't empty. They are actually full, largely of water. So you get very significant increases in pressure as you go deep, effectively getting hydrostatic pressure increases. And we're looking to find reservoirs, the sort of reservoirs that have held oil and gas for and CO2 in a number of cases for many millions of years. So you're looking for those reservoirs where you can inject the CO2 into the rock, into the water-laden rock, and also at those depths we have the water is actually highly saline, probably twice the concentration of seawater. But importantly, on top of these reservoir rocks, highly impervious layers of mudstone, siltstone, claystones that actually cap off the reservoirs so that the CO2 will stay in those locations.
similarly to what has happened with oil and gas and CO2 reservoirs in the past.
Mm. It's incredible to me that you have to have this level of knowledge of the geology of the region you're looking at. How do you go about determining where these particular regions are?
Well, this is one of the fortunate things, I guess, is that a lot of the technologies, a lot of the understanding of the geology and what have you are exactly the same sort of techniques that have been employed to find locations for oil and gas over many years. The geological surveys, the oil and gas exploration companies and so on have techniques like seismic surveys, magnetic surveys and so on to identify initially targets. So once you have that, then companies go and look at physical drilling to look for cores, to get validation of the seismic and other surveys that exist.
I suspect, given what you just said, you're also looking for locations under the oceans as well as just on the land. Is that true?
Yes. As oil and gas production is both onshore and offshore, you'd go to where you have that sort of architecture or that positioning and adjacency of the reservoirs and the seals. In fact, one of the largest trials that has been going on since 1997 in the North Sea, associated with the what's called the Sleipner field, where they've been injecting 1 million tonnes a year of CO2 for over 10 years.
Mm. Let's bring it all together for a moment. You have the capture part, you have the storage part. Where is the primary cost occurring? Is it evenly distributed amongst those two areas, or is it all in storage?
The way we look at the economics is generally to come up with a cost per tonne of CO2 avoided, because at the end of the day, we're looking at reductions. On that basis, the proportion of costs to capture are the largest, possibly 70 or 80%. And that's why a lot of the work, certainly in the capture area that we're looking at, is very much looking to drive down those costs. There are still significant amounts of money in terms of the equipment for transportation, injection, and so on. But once you get an economy of scale, if you like, of collecting significant amounts of the CO2 and what we term hubbing those emissions together, they, on a dollar per tonne basis, come down to a smaller proportion. But certainly there are a significant cost in both ends of capture and storage.
You're listening to Melbourne University Up Close. I'm Dr. Shane Huntington, and we're speaking with Barry Hooper about carbon capture and storage. Barry, let's move on now to the issue of power generation. Take us through an example of a typical coal-fired power station and the types of overall modifications and additional costs in generating power that we will start to see should this technology be widely adopted.
The traditional coal-fired power station, for instance, and I start there because the fossil fuel industry is really where carbon capture and storage is most applicable. And around the world, coal still constitutes a significant proportion of electricity generated, and even more so in the developing countries, and certainly the growth in China and India is going to result in new power stations. So traditionally, the pulverized fuel power stations will require those that exist today, potentials for retrofit, where we're looking at the different types of separation techniques. The potential is that you could just take that gas that's coming from the power station, put it through a process, almost like an add-on process, and the integrations really come in how you integrate the energy usage from the existing power station to the capture plant. And there will be integrations in terms of, it's largely heat exchange between some of the higher heat sources and the lower heat users for the carbon capture process. And there will be integrations around turbines and so on. That's all engineering revisions and technology changes which are being addressed and understood. One of the interesting aspects of this is significant focus on new types of power generation technology, and particularly gasification, where the fossil fuel source, say coal, is partially oxidized. You don't actually burn it as you do in a pulverized power station. You partially oxidize the solid fuel and produce what we call a synthesis gas, which is a gas that contains carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, hydrogen, and some other contaminants, but largely you are converting solid fuels to a gas. Is it at high temperature and high pressure, and then you actually burn those gases through through a turbine, somewhat similar to that used for natural gas combined cycle production of energy. There are slightly different applications of the different separation techniques in that what we call pre-combustion, the gasification, where you remove the CO2 prior to the final combustion of those gases. And so the integration of those, largely bringing these in as a new build to power stations, is an interesting new feature of the carbon capture and power generation components of CCS.
Now, the CO2 Cooperative Research Centre program has a number of industry groups it's interacting with and presumably a number of field trials. Tell us a bit about these industries that you're working with and the sorts of, I guess, real-life scenarios that are going on.
We have the involvement of large international companies in the oil and gas and the resources industries, as well as generators and other associated organisations who really see this as an issue that needs to be addressed for both for their industries and also for the community. Where we're looking at research activities around capture and storage, the other component is very much on demonstrations, because at the end of the day, while all these techniques have been used and are applied in various forms at various sizes, where we're looking at it for large-scale and deep cuts of CO2, we really have to go to put together some equipment that's larger than has been done, and this form of new industry effectively has to be developed. And so it's about getting ever-increasingly sized demonstrations in place. Where the capture issue, as I mentioned, was around cost, around the storage, is to demonstrate that both from a regulatory perspective and technical perspective, that to give confidence to the communities and to governments about this is a technique. We've been involved in some demonstrations of storage. Most recently, a project we call the CO2-CRC Otway project, which is injection of 100,000 tonnes of CO2 into a region in Western Victoria here in Australia. We've found that it's taken several years to put this project together, and it's the two main aspects of it. Firstly, to bring along governments and legislators to understand how you need to put together the protocols, etc., for this new industry. But from a technical perspective, also to look at monitoring and verifying that the CO2 is staying where it should, and that, as we expect it will, to raise that level of confidence.
Barry Hooper, Chief Technologist of the CO2 Cooperative Research Centre here at the University of Melbourne, Australia. Thank you for being our guest today on Up Close.
Thank you, Shane.
Relevant links, a full transcript and more info on this episode can be found on our website at upclose.unimelb.edu.au. We also invite you to leave your comments or feedback on this or any episode of Up Close. Simply click on the Add New Comment link at the bottom of the episode page. Melbourne University Up Close is brought to you by the Marketing and Communications Division in association with Asia Institute of the University of Melbourne, Australia. Our producers for this episode were Kelvin Parham and Eric Van Bemmel. Audio recording by Craig MacArthur. Theme music performed by Sergio Ecole. Melbourne University Up Close is created by Eric Van Bemmel and Kelvin Parham. I'm Dr. Shane Huntington. Until next time, goodbye.
You've been listening to Melbourne University Up Close, a fortnightly podcast of research, personalities, and cultural offerings of the University of Melbourne, Australia. Up Close is available on the web at upclose.unimelb.edu.au. That's upclose.unimelb.edu.au. Copyright 2008, University of Melbourne.